Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to Film Sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplex and the art house. What's new on video and streaming, and you might also hear about some dead people we like.
We don't have time for dead people we don't like.
Anyway, this is Film Sociology, where you'll find out what's the next cinematic marvel.
It was unbelievable!
And what's just a movie.
Shut up! My God, you have no freaking life!
Okay, here's your host and my dad, Matthew Soci.
Hello there, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Soci. The show is available on iTunes and, like all of the podcasts here at WFYI, available on Spotify. Well, friends, we got through another week. Hope you're doing all right. We'll get to the grab a pencil portion much later on. I have a very special guest on this week's program back in Indianapolis. So fun to have my guest in studio as opposed to on the phone. Nothing wrong with that. But the last six months, I'd been doing two plays. One as a director, one as an actor. So it's been kind of good to get back into the swing of things, watching movies in a theater. I actually wound up going to two movies on Tuesday at a certain chain multiplex where they have a Tuesday special, and they were both films that we're a little subpar. I finally watched Amsterdam, which was decent. A lot of good people in it. Could have been tighter. and then I saw Don't Worry, Darling, which was exactly what I thought it would be. Basically, the Stepford Wives meets the Truman Show, and not nearly as good as either one of those. So it was one of those sad moments where the controversy, the scandal, the news about the film off the screen made more news than the film on the screen. Florence Pugh and Chris Pine are the best things about that film. But yeah. But it's also one of those, I'm sure some people liked it because it was the Stepford Wives meets the Truman Show, but not me. Or, you know, it's that fine line between if you like it, it's an homage. If you don't like it, it's a ripoff. So. But opening in theaters this weekend, not one, but two films I'm glad to share with you this week. First is Called Jane, which is a film that was written and directed by Phyllis Nagy, best known for writing the film Carol. She also directed Mrs. Harris. This is the one with Elizabeth Banks as not Betty Draper, but darn close, more of a pulse and a personality. But she plays a suburban housewife in Chicago in 1968. There's this amusing opening of they're at a party for her husband, who's working on becoming a partner, Chris Messina. And we see the Chicago riots about to begin. And what we find out is Banks' character winds up getting pregnant. She already has a 15-year-old daughter and wants to get rid of it. But where? But how? They did the proper channels and went to a hospital, and the hospital board rejected it. So she goes and gets involved with an underground abortion organization led by Sigourney Weaver. And as time goes on, she's first made fun of for being the suburban housewife, making cookies for bake sales and all that sort of thing. And it is that trope we've seen of the suburban person in their bubble finally breaking out of their bubble. I mentioned Betty Draper. It's kind of like that. If Betty Draper's, you know, the January Jones character from Mad Men, starred in Year of the Dog, which is a really good film with Molly Shannon. Molly Shannon plays a kind of meek, introverted person, an animal lover, and by the end of the film has turned into a diehard animal rights activist, like an extreme animal rights activist. And that's kind of the pattern with this film. And this is, like I kind of mentioned with Don't Worry, Darling, I don't mind the journey that this film takes on that. It does remind me of Year of the Dog in a good way. It's not the perfect film. It's like I said, we have the suburban unaware, city well aware. We got that. And it does wrap up a little clean, a little too clean for my taste. But it ends with Roe versus Wade. We're going to get a lot of films like this now, friends. I just got done doing a production of Lysistrata, which was set a month before the 2020 election. And the play's stock rose because of the Roe v. Wade overturn. And the fact that we end it with Roe v. Wade being born. There's some great debates amongst the women in the group, especially women of color, on who gets abortions and who doesn't. And we have one doctor, and Banks winds up graduating so much from driving potential patients to assisting the doctor to actually performing the operations herself. So we get into that underground world and what it means and what they need to do in order to survive, on top of the Banks character who's trying to not let anybody in her family know. There's a great moment, the great moment that happens when a police officer shows up at the house looking like scruffy old Serpico and wants to get some assistance from the Banks character as opposed to trying to arrest her. And then that's when the husband finds out what's been going on. Anyway, it's good performances by Banks and Weaver and the cast across the board. And the fact that, yes, there is an underground group, but they don't always agree on things. And it's stuff that this is 1968, and we're still talking about it in 2022. So look for Call Jane. It's out in theaters. As well as the Korean neo-noir Decision to Leave. This is from director and writer Park Chan-wook, best known for the original Old Boy. He did Thirst, Stoker. The Handmaiden was the last one I saw. We have a very determined police detective. He's got insomnia issues. He is investigating a body that fell off a cliff due to climbing, but we think he has been pushed off. And the police detective becomes very infatuated with the dead man's wife, who also happens to be a suspect, especially with her lack of emotions, finding out about her dead husband. We find out that her DNA was under the husband's fingernails. And how does that happen? So he becomes more and more obsessed with the subject, with the suspect, and starts to integrate himself into her life. There's early on, there was a nice homage to Sharky's Machine where he is following her and watching her from afar. And then a coupling starts to happen. And then there's the coupling while he's trying to keep things going regularly in his house with his wife. And there's a lot of nice camera work about where he is, what's going on in the detective's mind and putting himself in a situation in his head, being in the suspect's apartment, being on top of the cliff. This is a police investigator who climbs the same route as the dead body, so he has an idea of what it's like to experience the climb. So, but yeah, it's and a pretty good climax on a beach. But it's a nice piece of noir that was done in Korean. And especially when we get near the end of the film and the couples kind of intertwine, not that way, but the couples do intertwine for some uncomfortable meetings. But yeah, it's worth checking out for Decision to Leave, which also opens this week. Now, we're going through some video titles, some that have been sent to me, some I've just been trying to catch up on. And we'll be talking a little bit with my special guest, Taffeta V. In a little bit, we're going to go at very long lengths over the 1978 thriller Eyes of Laura Mars, because Halloween's coming up. And speaking of Halloween, so friends, I want to thank the gang over at Indie CD and Vinyl. They had this video, this DVD, on display for sale, and I had heard about it, but had never seen it. And I also want to thank Patton Oswalt for bringing this to my attention. That's right, friends. I actually watched the DVD Deathbed, The Bed That Eats. That's what it's called. I know Patton calls it The Bed That Eats People. Was originally started shooting in 1972, wound up getting finished in 1977. The story behind it is fascinating, as the film itself, it's pretty self-explanatory. It's also a low enough budget that it's bonkers in its own way. The bed, when it consumes things, You're given a filter. It almost looks like it's being fried. It's in that kind of vegetable oil sheen to it. So everything from candles to human body parts to skulls. There's a moment where there's a skull eaten, but the hair is still intact. That's funny. I mean, so it's that kind of budgetary restrictions. They're making the most out of a very silly concept, and for the most part it works. It's only 80 minutes, thank goodness. There's always also fun reverse camera work, like one of the victims is trying to crawl away, and a bed sheet ties itself to the ankle of the victim and drags them back. So we get this kind of weird backstory of somebody who is cursed and has to watch from behind a painting to watch the victims of title of the film, which apparently only needs to be fed once every decade. Not the best sound diet, but there you go. There's a video, there's an introduction by the director who only did one other project. But yeah, they made the most of it and they finished it. And so I think if you heard the Patton Oswalt bit, you know, he talks about the fact that he can't finish a screenplay, but somehow Deathbed, the bed that eats, actually was finished, financed, sort of, and shot and completed. So there's something to be said about that. Even the bad films we make fun of, even something like The Room or Miami Connection. So this isn't as fun of though as those, but this is probably the unofficial pizza and beer movie pick of the week. But yeah, it's out from a Cult Epics release on DVD, Deathbed, The Bed That Eats, This Film Exists. Also from Blue Underground, a one I had always heard of but had never seen, the Larry Cohen film God Told Me To. Now, I got to meet Larry Cohen briefly on the set of Original Gangsters when I was doing an interview on a profile on Fred Williamson for Film Threat magazine. But pretty good cast in this one. Tony LoBianco, Sandy Dennis, Sylvia Sidney, Sam Levine, Richard Lynch, Deborah Rafin, a then-unknown Andy Kaufman, who has a pivotal role as a police officer. But but Tony LoBianco plays a police detective and apparently a repressed Catholic who's investigating a series of murders in which the commonality is the perpetrator has whispered the words, "God told me to." It starts out with a very strong Charles Whitman-like shooting on top of a water tower, then a police officer during a St. Patrick's Day parade, which, listening to the commentary track, Larry Cohen didn't have a license and just kind of ran on. He and Kaufman ran into the parade and filmed the bits, and then they had to do a second parade at another day just to get some to finish the scenes. But what first turns out to be just a simple investigation of a series of murders turns into supernatural. There is Tony LoBianco's faith is kind of challenged, and it's not just a murder plot. It is a connection between powers that are not of this earth. Let's put it that way. So he takes an idea and kind of expands on it. And decent performances from the actors I've already mentioned. And it goes further down a road I didn't expect. So, yeah, it's worth checking out on DVD from Blue Underground, God Told Me To. Now, friends, and thank you, Simon Majumdar, for letting me rant wonderfully about this. We all have gaps in our film watching. It's just a bigger shock when it's somebody like the host of a film podcast. There are those films you're surprised you haven't seen, and you feel better when you finally do, because it's kind of better late than never. I've always heard about This Sporting Life and never gotten around to it, and then I found it at a bookstore that specializes in half-price items. So This Sporting Life is the feature film debut from Lindsay Anderson, who is best known for films like If, Oh Lucky Man, Whales of August, Britain Britannica, oh, the hospital one. Sorry, I've just had a brain freeze. And this was the kind of career-changing film for Richard Harris, as well as Rachel Roberts, both whom received Academy Award nominations. But yeah, this is of the kitchen sink dramas from the 50s, and this is from 1963. Harris plays a rugby player in a small in London town of Yorkshire. But Harris is a guy who's just trying to make a name for himself in the rugby world, and when he does, fame and fortune is not all it's set out to be for him. He wants more, but he doesn't know how to handle it. And first off, the Lindsay Anderson, who started out doing documentaries and brings that documentary feel to this film, the rugby scenes are amazing. And this is 1963. There are times where the Richard Harris character is just as brutal off the field as he is on the field. And this is 17 years before Raging Bull. There's a documentary, there's a couple of supplements, documentaries about Lindsay Anderson, and one of the talking heads in one of them is Martin Scorsese, which explains a lot. The more powerful and more famous the Harris character becomes, the harder it is for him to show his emotions. And he lives shares a house with a widow of a factory, a miner that he worked with. And there's a connection, and there's a different connection between Richard Harris and Rachel Roberts in that aspect. So, yeah, it's a really wonderful, can't take your eyes off of it, and not just Harris, who's great, and Roberts, who's excellent. But I've always been intrigued, I think, by those who can't turn it on and turn it off. And obviously, I have said that Raging Bull is a masterpiece. And this, by the way, this is a great double feature, The Sporting Life and Raging Bull. Don't do that. Don't have that as a double feature. But you understand why. They're very complementary to each other. And, this is the one, like I said, this is the one that kind of put Harris on the map. And his career just skyrocketed after this. But, yeah, I was really glad I was able to finally see this. And if you haven't, and I don't know if it's on the Criterion Channel because I have the physical copy right here in front of me. So this Sporting Life, it's out on Criterion. Thank you, Lindsay Anderson. Thank you, Richard Harris. And thank you, Rachel Roberts. And another one is one I can't believe I didn't have this, and I found it for $1, but I got to revisit Stand and Deliver. So the Oscar-nominated performance with Edward James Olmos. We get a fun performance from Lou Diamond Phillips. I forgot Andy Garcia was in this as one of the administrators near the end of the film. But still holds up. Still fun to watch. And we're still waiting to find out who's Calculus. So, yeah, that's what I've been watching this week. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Before we grab a pencil, we got a long, fun chat. So I've had Taffy on as a guest over the years, and travels and life things happen, and Taffy is back in Indianapolis, so a great excuse to have her back in studio. But first, her introduction.
Moneypenny, what gives?
Me, given an ounce of encouragement. You never take me to dinner looking like this, James. You never take me to dinner, period.
I would, you know. Only Em would have me court-martialed for illegal use of government property.
Flattery will get you nowhere, but don't stop trying.
I've never been to Istanbul.
You've never been to Istanbul?
No.
Where the moonlight on the Bosphorus is irresistible.
Maybe I should get you to take me there someday. I've tried everything else.
Darling Moneypenny, you know I never even look at another woman.
Oh, really, James?
Mm-hmm. Let me tell you the secret of the world. Now, what do you know about gold, Moneypenny?
Oh, the only gold I know about is the kind you wear. You know, on the third finger of your left hand.
Mm. Well, one of these days, we really must look into that.
Well, what about tonight? You come around for dinner, and I'll cook you a beautiful angel cake.
Well, nothing would give me greater pleasure, but unfortunately, I do have a business appointment.
That's the flimsiest excuse you've ever given me. Ah, well, some girls have all the luck. Who is she, James?
She is me, Miss Moneypenny.
And kindly omit the customary byplay with 007. He's dining with me.
I don't want him to be late.
So there's hope for me yet.
Moneypenny, won't you ever believe me?
In you go, sir.
Thank you, ma'am.
Oh, by the way, how was the girl?
Which girl?
The Chinese one we fixed you up with.
Oh, another 5 minutes, I'd have found out.
She'll never know what she missed.
Miss Moneypenny, give 007 the password we've agreed with Japanese SIS.
Yes, sir. We tried to think of something that you wouldn't forget.
Yes.
I love you. Repeat it, please, to make sure you get it.
Don't worry. I get it.
Your passport is quite in order.
Well, anyone seeing you in that outfit, Moneypenny, would most certainly be discouraged from leaving the country. What can I bring you back from Holland?
A diamond? In a ring?
Would you settle for a tulip?
Yes.
Hi, Taffy.
Hi, Mr. Soucy.
Good to have you back in studio. There's nothing wrong with you on the phone, but just as, you know, in studio is even better.
It's always better in the studio, yes.
And welcome back.
Thank you so much. I live here now.
I know. So yeah. Toledo's loss is Indy's gain.
That's correct.
And we'll save that for another time over cocktails somewhere else while we pitch our business ideas.
That's right.
But friends, sometimes the internet is used for good. And I like to say that film sociology is a great example of that from time to time. And I was going across the box of movies that had been sent to me. Thank you, Kina Lorber. And I mentioned something, and my page exploded, thanks to Taffy, because I had watched something that was a huge influence on young Taffy back in the late 70s. And I was glad to revisit. And part of the reason why I revisited this film, Long Setup, is one, of course, Halloween is coming up, so I wanted to come up with scary or suspenseful movies for the holiday. Also been inspired by our mutual friends at Golan Globus Theater, who in the month of October have been doing Gialloween for you fans of Italian horror. How's your Giallo?
Well, you mean how much
I've seen? Yeah.
You know, I think that I have a really good sort of base coat, a little primer of Giallo.
Okay.
So I've seen the biggies, but I haven't really ever done a deep dive. And I think I would like to do more of that.
So, and I think obviously their Gialloween episodes, check it out, Golan Globus Theater.
Yes.
Is a great example of that. I think I need to do that as well. It's my, I think we've hit
the Argento,
the landmarks.
The
Fulci, Suspiria,
yes,
and all that.
Exactly.
Anything with David Hemmings, that's always good. Now, friends, we are going to talk about, which is probably the first American studio attempt to make a Giallo film. And at first I was going to be snarky and say it's Giallo light. But for the film itself, it follows the rules.
And yeah, it's just light at all.
You know what? It has more of a budget. It has a bigger budget.
Fair.
Oh,
fair,
so,
yeah.
And we are talking about 1978. Am I saying that right? 1978.
Yes, correct.
Yep. Eyes of Laura Mars.
Oh, yeah.
Directed by Irvin Kershner. This is before Empire Strikes Back. This is the follow-up to her Academy Award-winning performance in Network. It stars Faye Dunaway. Mm-hmm. Screenplay by John Carpenter. Mm-hmm. He had already, I believe this, did this come out after or before Halloween?
It came out after Halloween. He had done an 11-page treatment for it that was picked up. And he really liked that script. But once I don't want to get ahead of things
no, that's
here.
Fine.
Is it okay? So it was supposed to star, and this is absurd. Hold on to your hats.
I know.
Barbara Streisand.
Because it was produced by
John Peters,
a.k.a. Bradley Cooper in Licorice Pizza.
Right.
There's no metal spider in this one either.
No.
And fortunately or unfortunately, Babs, I don't know her, didn't want to do it because of the provocative
kink
material.
Yeah.
And we kind of say, thanks, Babs.
Thank you.
Because you got Faye Dunaway, which is a pretty good snag.
That's a good trade up there.
Yeah,
that's
it's pretty good trade. So thank you, Crazy John.
Yeah. The epic 70s madman, John Peters. And so when she bailed on it and they signed on Faye Dunaway, the studio demanded a rewrite, and while Carpenter was involved with the rewrite, he had to collaborate with David Zella Goodman, and Carpenter hates this rewrite. He says that he felt like the original script was really good, and that this was all, you know, sort of studio notes, and that he blames
that she put
Goodman,
air quotes
yes,
for radio friends for podcasts.
Yeah, I gotta stop doing
no, that's okay.
But he blames him for, you know, kind of crapping all over the script.
David Sela Goodman, yeah. Also known for such films as Strangers of Bombay, Lovers and Other Strangers, Monty Walsh, collaborated with Sam Peckinpah on not a first date film, Straw Dogs, Man on a Swing, Fair Mel, My Lovely, Logan's Run, March or Die, and then there was this. And he wound up doing two more films after that. So anyway, Now the other reason to have Taffy on for this, because I got to her first before the Golan guys, because it's 70s, it's fashion,
yeah,
it's fashion photography, and very fashionable men. So we're going to get to that. So Faye Dunaway plays the title character, Laura Marr. She is a controversial fashion photographer based, who are we supposed to say it's loosely based or inspired or lifted from?
Well, the work that is depicted as hers was Helmut Newton's work.
Okay.
And he was already working sort of in that vibe that they're showing here, which is a very giallo kind of vibe. He was already doing highly stylized, extremely posed sort of vignette things that were deeply fusing violence and sexuality. If you are trying to conjure any images of Helmut Newton's photography from that era, you can think about basically anything that you're seeing with a lot of very shiny, very not very dressed people posed in sort of almost like a glamorous murder situation.
Right.
A glamorous crime scene photo. So he was doing a lot of that already. And that's why they went to him for those images.
Okay.
And we see those very large in the opening scene of her art show, where I love that this is far back enough that they're questioning, is photography art?
Yes. It almost goes in the network television because of the controversy of art. It's going to corrupt the suburban youth.
It's not really art, is it? What about paintings? It's not really art if you're not painting it.
Well, what if the dead bodies in their lingerie were holding a bowl of fruit?
Right.
Would it be art?
A still life?
Right, exactly.
Right.
And there is a scene earlier. I know a lot of deep knee bends for Faye Dunaway in this film with long skirts and doing photography poses.
If I had gams like that, I'd spend a lot of time doing that.
Same.
Too.
But there's also a famous, and this here's the other thing. You also get grungy New York in the 70s.
Yes, my favorite.
Which I'm like, I don't think they did much set design. I believe there was a garbage strike going on, and they were able to utilize some of that. But there's one in particular that I'm impressed with because they shot in Times Square with flaming cars and half-dressed women. Was it Times Square or
was
it another?
It was not Times Square.
Sorry.
I think it was, oh.
But it's a section, but I mean, they had the block. This was one they had the block off.
Yes.
They had to block this off. Now, I'm sure Mr. Kirshner did some stuff on the fly, maybe, but it's also, you had a studio backing them, so.
No, I think they had enough money to throw at it to do it the right way.
Okay,
he wasn't
fair
running
enough.
And gunning like a. Like
Larry
a,
Cohen.
Or a John Waters right. Dreamland kind of thing where
okay,
they're just
going
to film it.
So, yeah, you get to see her in action. Now, the plot is. She sees murders through her from her own point from the point of view of the killer as they are happening, like an Italian film. Doesn't explain why.
No.
It just is.
Yes.
And sometimes filmmakers, you could try that sometime. I remember when
it
just happened.
I like allowing your audience to fill in the gaps. I like giving them a little credit for being intelligent and not over explaining everything.
No.
That always feels like a lot of studio notes. And I don't need to be, I don't need to be talked down to. I can fill in the gaps.
This film would have an extra 30 minutes and Faye would have had a concussion. And
there would have been some explanation.
Yeah. So it just happens, friends.
And the other thing that I really enjoyed about this and about that portion of it that you're talking about, where she has these visions, and we don't really know why. We can tell that they're visions because they are slightly softer focus, and they are definitely point of view of the murderer when they come to her. And she's, definitely in a state of shock when this is happening. But I really like that even when she begins talking to the cops, when she's talking to friends, coworkers, etc.,
aka
about it.
Everyone is a red herring.
Everyone's a red herring.
We're not in this film, and we're red herrings.
We're red herrings. Absolutely, we could have been set up for it.
Wait,
as well.
I'm sorry. Gary Oldman screaming, "Everyone,
everyone." But I really like that the way they treat her visions, and the way she treats the fact that she's having visions is with a sense of reality. Mm-hmm. It's grounded. There is gravitas to it. This is not just some flaky woman. Well, you know, there's not. I mean, yes, the cops kind of blow her off because it does sound like crazy talk. But the whole scope of the film does not treat what is happening to her and what she is seeing lightly or in a trivial manner. They don't blow it off. They don't try and pass it off as some kind of hysteria. We're doing air quotes again.
Yes, you are. Women problems.
Women problems. Somebody who's too dramatic, that kind of thing. We really dig into the fact that she's seeing things. This is different and it needs to be investigated. And that, I thought, was really great. That the caliber of actors that we have in here, all of these things, along with the money, really ground it in reality. So while it's a wacky giallo and it has all of the blood and the gore and the kind of craziness and the sexiness.
But I don't think it's as much as an Italian film.
No, but I mean, we still do get some bright red blood.
Yeah.
We still do get plenty of boobs. You know. And
a lot of earth tones.
Oh,
a lot of
the brown and
a lot
the beige,
of browns.
The brown and
yeah.
The beige.
Oh my gosh.
It's her entire apartment. I can't remember who the production designer was, but her entire apartment is just a sea of taupe and putty.
Yes.
And mushroom. Her bed.
Wait, these are the extra fairies in A Midsummer Night's Dream.
These are the colors. The color palette is all just cement and oatmeal. And
also cards from American Psycho, business card colors.
Yes, exactly.
Bone.
But it really is. It's just this sea of sort of earth tones and her bedroom. Her bed is on a platform surrounded by mirrors. There's a lot of smoked glass and chrome. Frankly, I would love to move into any of her spaces. We need to talk about those living spaces because this is New York.
I know. Is it like Lois Lane's apartment where it's probably in real life $40,000 a month?
You know, it's the craziest.
You could buy a
place.
McMansion on the north side.
And
for
I know
the...
that this was, I know this was 1978, but the places where she resides are absolutely out of hand.
Yes.
She's got this enormous apartment that's beautifully appointed in shades of mushroom. She has, on top of that, she has a studio by the water.
Another $60,000 a month.
I just want to live there. You know, and it's got, you know, great light and windows and, you know, unfinished beams and things. Fantastic. And then the place that she had with her ex-husband, Raul Julia.
Oh, we'll get to the men in a second.
Good. That's why you had me on here. The place that she had with her ex-husband was also just phenomenal.
Yep.
So we have these unrealistic living spaces. We also have the idea that a photographer, an art/fashion photographer, is a living large like this. So clearly we're in the realm of fantasy.
Because in real life, if you're lucky, you're living in Brad Dourif's apartment, which we'll get to in a little bit.
Yeah, you know? If you're lucky.
So she mentions the men. Here are the men in this film who, by the way, not since Mahogany, when Billy Dee Williams had better hair than Diana Ross.
And
the men I'm going to mention in this film all have better hair than Faye Dunaway, and that says something. Here we go. Your police officer, young, not crabby old man, Tommy Lee Jones. Mm. Your driver with a pass, again, all suspects, curly-haired, bearded Brad Dourif. Long, more When You Coming Back, Red Rider than One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Yeah.
The Eve Arden of the film, playing Faye Dunaway's assistant with so much feathered hair, the back of his head looks like a butt. Thank you, Margaret Cho. Rene Auger-Benoit, one of the great Robert Altman players.
Yes.
And yes, ex-husband, not Gomez yet, Raul Julia. This is pre-playing Dracula on stage in New York. And then you have Frank Adonis. And if you hit the pause button, you will see young, dark-haired, dark curly-haired, mustachioed Michael Tucker.
Really?
Yes, for you fans of L.A. Law out there and Radio Days. But yeah, here these are the men, as yeah. Taffy is thinking, putting them in a lineup.
Sure. They all did it.
So where do you want to start with the guys? I know you made notes on hair and wardrobe.
I did. Well, okay. I mean, hair and wardrobe is my thing.
Yes.
I am the wardrobe mistress. So obviously, this being centered around fashion during an era that I really like is a lot of fun. And so there are fashions of the era that we're seeing on the models. So the things that we see that were a little more off the rack were Halston's and Yves Saint Laurent. Mostly that's what we saw there. And then the rest of the sort of just wardrobe-y level costumes, you know, cops and things like that. The costume designs, and as always, I apologize in advance for any mispronunciations I may make. But a Greek costume designer named Theone V. Alderidge. She was actually a stage costume designer, many Tony Awards. I mean, things like A Chorus Line, Annie, you know, just little stuff like
little
that.
Little things, yeah.
Little things.
Not much.
And multiple Tonys, also multiple awards for her film work.
Well, you know, within walking distance of work.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, so she was really able to sort of tap into the fact that this was New York and that there's the high fashion of it and then the low-end fashion of it. And so that's why everybody looks great but a little sleazy. And that happens to be my favorite combination.
Yes,
sleazy glamour is my vibe. And so she's really put everybody in some gorgeous stuff. The models, scantily clad at best, a lot of glitter, a lot of sheen to everybody. And then the fellas are a little more grounded in reality. And Tommy Lee Jones, this is one of his early roles, but you just can't get away from his charisma. Even early on, he is just amazingly intense.
Yeah, there was the Betsy where he was a stock car driver.
Yes.
He was already, I believe, William Devane's sidekick in Violence and Rolling Thunder. But yeah, he had.
Right.
It's funny you mentioned. I'm thinking of him because I had just recently reviewed the DVD or the Blu-ray release of The Rainmaker, the Burt Lancaster, Catherine Hepburn film. There was a televised version with Tommy Lee Jones as Starbuck. And everyone's favorite spinster, Tuesday Weld. And your brothers, I believe the brothers were James Cromwell and William Catt. Yeah, it's on YouTube. Look this up. But anyway, but yeah, this is before he got old and craggly and got settled and got paid way more to be old and craggly.
He's got a terrific sort of Susie Quattro shag haircut, which
yes.
I'm hot for it. I love it. And he is featured throughout.
Somebody put a side-by-side picture on the internet, please.
Yes, I will get on that soon as I leave. But aside from that, he is basically featured most of the time in one of my favorite autumn menswear looks. Gentlemen, take notes, please. He's got a turtleneck and then a jacket. Sometimes the jacket is tweedy and sometimes the jacket is leathery, and I like both of them.
The last two weekends I had to do quality time with Mrs. Sosi, and it was too damn hot to wear a turtleneck. I was irate.
That is sad. Happy anniversary, by the way.
Thank you. But one of which was the American Pianist Association. So you have to say that carefully. And
auntie.
Yes, that's right. So that's where I had to MC that thing, and as I will tell the story, it was Sunday morning, and I opened up the closet, and I just looked at my clothes and said, "Please fit. You don't have to fit well, but please fit." And I knew it was going to be too warm for a turtleneck, and I found it was great because Lynn could hear. She was in bed, and she heard me exclaim when a white shirt buttoned.
Yeah,
because this was like the first time in probably almost 3 years I've had to wear something for work. So,
right.
I was very lucky. But yes, turtlenecks are my jam. Turtlenecks help us out in all kinds of ways.
Turtlenecks are great. I'm wearing one right now.
Yes, you are, dear.
By
the way, give my best to the gang from Hairspray, the original version. Are you going as Pia Zadora this week?
I always kind of want to dress like a beatnik. I always want to be an extra in Bucket of Blood.
Yes.
You know. It's true.
Or a Beastie Boys video, you know, any of those. Anyway, I'm sorry. I interrupt you. Turtlenecks and jackets,
so,
guys.
So yeah. we've got that on the fantastic Tommy Lee Jones. And then Raul Julia is, thank God, they depict him at night, at home, which means we get to see him in some beautiful silk pajamas with paisleys on them, which is very nice, and I appreciate that.
Thank you, pause button.
Thank you. And
also the ex-husband, capital E, capital H. Did we emphasize that everybody in this film is a suspect?
Yeah, they really set it up for looking like him, but, you know, turns out it's not. And then we've got Brad Dourif, who, I swear to God, the way he looks in this, that guy made me a fancy cocktail at a way too hip for me bar within the past year. He absolutely looks like every hipster that you know now. He's got a beard and a longer, shaggier hair. Frankly, he looks super foxy.
Kind of does, yeah. But he's a limo driver foxy. With a record.
Yeah, with a record, that's... and we're all very afraid of that.
And we're not. We won't give away the ending because I'll get to that.
It's like a 40-year-old movie, Matt.
Yeah, I know it is.
We're not spoiling it for anybody.
But here's the thing. No, here's the thing. I will say. I will give you this. I remember watching this on cable. In the late 70s, early 80s.
Sure.
And so I had not seen this was my gateway to giallo, which sure. I need to make better. So I, 10-year-old me didn't see this coming.
Right.
I want to keep it that way. So just out of respect for...
I guess.
You guess. All right. So, all right. So
whatever. Dad.
You're dad, come on. Everybody
we're
knows
the same
this.
Age.
Yeah, I know. That's fine. Well, yeah, but I look older and I made more life choices.
It's true.
Not necessarily the best ones. Anyway, continue, dear.
Brad Dourif, yeah, looking extra foxy in this. And so we've got all of these men sort of flanking all of these scantily clad models and women and of course, Faye Dunaway. And it's really, I don't know, it's full of all of the things that we want and expect from giallo, but it's got a bit more of a high-minded sensibility about it, and I think that that's kind of fun. Like you said, it's got sort of more money behind it, and I think that that makes the whole thing, I don't know, it kind of clings together a little better. And when I watch it now, because I just revisited it yesterday to make sure that, you know, I hadn't forgotten anything, I think that it holds up, except for, and it would behoove us to actually talk about this, some of the more basic sensibilities that we had then. This is 1978. So
are we talking about Donald Phelps?
Well, we're talking about just sort of in general, because it okay. comes up in a variety of different ways. The language we use and the attitudes that we have about things
yeah.
like gender presentation.
Right.
About mental illness. You know, it's 1978. And I think that this, my sense of it, because I was alive then, even though I was very young, but seeing sort of the transitions and then knowing a little bit about history and also, you know, being more aware of things now, I think that they were really trying to be serious about the subject matter and
oh, yeah.
to use the information that they had at the time in the best way possible. But that said, when a character cross-dresses, that doesn't make them a suspect.
No, and, you know, and this is brought up if you've ever seen the great documentary The Celluloid Closet.
Oh, yes,
which
yes.
Is,
fantastic.
Which is a great documentary about the history of the image of gays and lesbians
yes.
in cinema. And when we get to the 70s, now it's either gays or lesbians and or cross-dressing is either used as a punchline or as a victim slash
perpetrator.
Yeah. So,
and I mean, we got to remember also that in the DSM manual, just being gay was considered a mental illness, and it was only removed in 1973. This 73 or 75, and then this movie comes out in 78. So we're only a few years away from that.
And a decade prior, you had to die for your ailment in the final reel of the film.
You had to die for it. So we've got, you know, we've got some kind of problematic things as we look at it in hindsight. I mean, this is also at a time when, because at the reveal at the end of who does it and why they do it, we're kind of dipping our toes into some behavioral sciences and profiling kinds of ideas, and we're really sort of sniffing around at that. But this was with blunt force. This is early on. John Douglas's behavioral science unit at the FBI was in its infancy at this time. So we're really only just starting to talk about these things. So our ideas of things like certain mental illnesses, like a dissociative personality disorder, just for example, and how they were depicted, we were still calling it multiple personalities. And we were still thinking that we were like flipping channels through a person's personalities rather than it being a complicated trauma response, yada, yada. So while those things are definitely thought of differently now, and we know better, we do better. I think that they were trying their best at the time to be kind of serious about it.
Yeah, and when they get to the reveal, there is not a big monologue, but just enough information to go, okay, this. So here's we do get a motive for the series of crimes, as opposed to
a psychological motive that's deep seated.
Yep,
and that is, I think, by the standards of that time, something that is a more sophisticated idea of a motive rather than just "I hate you" or crime of passion.
And this is coming up at the rise of the slasher films, which would dominate multiplexes for the next, well, still. And then we also have a moment where we have a red herring of a red herring of. I want to mention René Auberjonois as Donald Phelps, as I mentioned, the assistant. I mentioned celluloid closet. In the 30s, he would open the dressing room door. And he kind of does this he opens the dressing room door and just barks at the models.
Yes.
And you know, goes for every whim of Laura's, which you're supposed to do, and then does a double fake on a police officer on the streets to distract them as a plot, drag as a plot point to help out his boss.
Yes.
And with extremely feathered hair.
Oddly, you know, it's so funny. I have this in my notes several times. And René Auberjonois' hair in this movie
is pretty amazing.
Is exactly like my mother's hair in that era. Oh, I wish that I had a picture.
Also for later.
Yeah. I'll have to dredge one up and send one to you. But yeah, I mean, it looked great. My mom was a stone cold fox. So, you know,
fox doesn't fall far from the tree.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Soucy. it's very stylized. And I think they're trying to be very serious about it. And even that character that he plays, which is a very broad sort of depiction of a classic idea of a very gay assistant and all.
Capital V, capital G, capital
yes,
A. Yeah.
But it's still, they still humanize him. And I think they still treat him, I mean, it's disrespectful by my standards now, but I think that they were kind of doing their best. Bless them.
And the fact that, you know, all the actors we've mentioned had already been established either on or off screen or on stage. I'm gonna say that the acting experience by this cast is more than probably the average Italian giallo film. I could be wrong. And again, style of acting is different in Italy than it was there.
Sure.
You know, the whole they dub everything, and this one they didn't. And again, the budget. So this is a really good gateway. If you like this and you want to see something
harder,
shorter and harder and grimier, and they're out there.
Yeah.
You can listen to Golden Globes Theater, among others.
Yeah.
But they are out there, and it's a fun popcorn romp.
I really like it.
As much as murdered people and, you know, photography and half
Tis the season. And the other great thing is they did keep Streisand on for the song.
Yeah.
And the song, I swear, it's a real Bondy kind of a feeling.
It is.
Don't you think
very
that
good
it's
money,
a very...
Penny. Yes.
Well, thank
a little bit of that. But, you know, she would demand way more money from the Broccoli family.
Of course.
So the fact that, you know, Crazy John's involved here, they're
fine. He is just such an epic madman of that era. Every story wilder than the previous.
It's kind of like there was a guy I used to read named Bill Simmons, and he had a thing called the Mike Tyson rules. Like anything he hears about Tyson, he absolutely thinks it's 100% accurate.
Yeah.
And I think John Peters is kind of like that.
Absolutely. Yeah. It was too much weird stuff there for it to not be true. You just couldn't make up that kind of thing. Another thing is
yes.
that sort of the main model that we have speaking throughout it, her name is Darlene Flugel, and I kept thinking, where do I know her from? Where do I know her
this
from?
This is what IMDb is for, friends.
I know, and so I looked her on up. And
I did Google Image because I'm a guy.
Right, yeah. But... I knew her very well because of she is in To Live and Die in L.A. She is the informant slash lover of William Peterson, one of my imaginary boyfriends.
Oh, okay. Well,
early 80s William Peterson.
Yeah,
hi.
I can see that. Stay over there. Her follow-up was Battle Beyond the Stars, which we have talked about to no end on this show.
Super fun. And
Once Upon a Time in America, Sergio Leone, mm-hmm. Running Scared, Tough Guys, Bulletproof, Deadly Stranger. Yeah, these have been to many video store shelves. Over
Running
the years.
Scared. Wait, the one with
Gregory Hines and Billy Crystal.
Okay, I have such a crush on Gregory Hines, and I love that movie.
Yes, especially when they're shaving, creaming the trees for winter in Chicago.
Hey, look.
Yeah, I know. No, so you're absolutely right. To Live and Die in L.A.
Yeah. So that's where I knew her from. So it's a really packed cast. It's a really fun movie, and I am. A huge fan of, you know, I think everybody has the era and genre that kind of informs them in early adolescence. You know, everybody kind of gravitates to one thing or another.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, there's this time period of, I'm going to say roughly 78 through about 81, where we are no longer in the groovy 70s, and we are not yet into the neon 80s.
Mm-hmm.
We are in this nebulous no man's land where it's kind of like coming down after a real long night. It's not super happy or optimistic anymore, but we're still kind of going hard with the partying.
I'll say it, and Reagan hasn't emerged yet.
Yeah. And so we're really, it's this sort of dying off of one era and the emergence of another. And I love the stuff that happens there. The movie Times Square is from this.
I was about to say, I know that. By the way, where can people find your readings and thoughts? Because, you know you were going to plug Times Square here.
Well, all right.
I know.
I am passionate about the movie Times Square.
Among
so
others.
So passionate, in fact, that I wrote a zine about it because I'm a Gen Xer. I still write zines. And you can actually see it and read the whole thing online on my website, which is just taffetav.com. And that's also where you can listen to me talking here with Mr. Soci and with other people and as well as on my own podcast.
I say, don't you also do like a Lynn Thigpen third shift radio for those who cannot sleep?
Hey, boppers. Yes. Thank you for letting me plug that. My big passion project, the thing that I like most to make in my life right now, is a little podcast, although it's not really a podcast. It's a radio show that I call Late. And I started it because I don't sleep and I needed something new to learn how to do. And I was really missing late night DJs from regular old radio, late night FM DJs, exactly like in the Warriors, Hey Boppers.
Or Adrian Barbeau
or
in
Adrian
the fog.
Barbeau in
or
the fog.
Tim Reed with a gong and
Tim
incense.
Tim Reed with a gong. Yeah, absolutely. In WKRP. Or Johnny LaGuardia in Times Square.
Yeah, Tim
and
Curry,
so
friends.
So we just don't have anything like that now where DJs DJs tell stories and read things and then play music that they choose. And so that's what
like,
I do.
Like Errol Garner's Play Misty for Me while Archer's mother is calling constantly.
Yes.
For you fans of Play Misty for
Me.
In fact,
in my first episode where I kind of set the stage for all of this stuff, I referenced every single one of those DJs because that's what I'm ripping off when I do it.
You get those DJs that you're number one in the market, no matter which city you're in.
It's true. But I think that there's just a big gap. And we don't have that kind of thing. We do have podcasts now. But with music and licensing, you know, it's really dicey. Yeah. So that is the only hitch of it. And happily now there's, the good and the bad of things is mine is available and it is legally made because I only distribute it on Spotify because they have the rights to all of the music that
there
I play.
So
if you're wondering why can't I find this on Apple Podcasts or, you know, wherever else, that's why, because I don't make the rules. And if I just played these things, I would be sued into the dirt and back.
We don't want that.
And we don't want that. And so this allows me to play the songs. And the songs are an integral part of each episode. Everything has a theme. And the songs and the stories and the poems and all are all true. And they are all, you know, available now because I use that platform.
Yep.
So until I get hired as a DJ for real somewhere.
Okay. All right, Eve. I know how this story winds up. You want a milkshake? Are we doing this now? I'm 52 and I have to be Margot Channing.
You get to be the Margot Channing.
No.
It could be the Showgirls one and I'll just shove you down the stairs.
I'm not getting on a scale before I go on the air. Not doing that. Oh, God.
It's true.
Great. My kid M will now want a drink. Well, so my kid is now M.
Yes.
They, them pronouns.
Excellent. Okay.
And I remember, sidebar, because we also do side tangents here. It's not just for Golden Globus
That's
anymore.
That's right.
But when I directed the play Born Yesterday, many, many moons ago at Scottish Rite, my lovely kid had created a new genre called Men in Suits Talking. So, because that's a lot. Well, and they considered Goodfellas Men in Suits Talking,
right,
when they're not whacking each other, killing. And then as time went on, I said that All About Eve is one of the greatest Men in Suits, Women in Gowns talking films of all time.
Yes.
And then
yes,
I finally got the convinced them to sit down and watch it.
Oh, good.
And yeah, the first.
Did they like it?
Oh, loved it.
Yeah,
first shot of Betty. Like, oh, that's me.
Yeah.
And then the realization in the party scene where they said, oh my God, her dress has pockets.
Yeah.
And I said, yeah, because Betty's got to keep her gin and smoke somewhere.
That's right.
You know, and it's the whole, I want to say these things to people. You could take your heart, you award, put it where your heart usually is. And, you know, it just, yeah.
It's that great Mankiewicz script. And
yeah,
there is a monologue in it about the nature of theater,
mm-hmm,
that gives me goosebumps every
yep
time I hear it. It's a flea circus. It's a rodeo. And it's just so inspiring. And, you know, Matt, you and I are both old school theater nerds.
We are.
We are just big old dorks about it.
Yep.
And I get a lump in my throat every time I hear that monologue. It's so great.
So I bring that up to bring up the fact that, and I brought this up to my lovely wife over the weekend. I've been wanting to, somewhere down the road with film sociology, we'll see, but you're talking about 78 to 82.
Yeah.
I've always been fascinated with about 75 till about 85 when the studios were making the shift to blockbuster,
right,
blockbuster or bust. You know, the corporate bean counters took over the studios, and the artists kind of got pushed aside for the most part. And there were films they would put all of their focus on one film and not worry about the other. So the smaller films that each studio had. And I was talking to my lovely wife Lynn because I brought up the film Car Wash.
Car Wash.
Love Car Wash. wonderful little ensemble piece. Michael Schultz directed it. A bunch of those
actually
people.
Really good movie.
Yeah, it's a day in the life of a Los Angeles car wash, and it, you know, like I said, Richard Pryor. I think he's got top billing, and he's in it for one. He had one day of shooting. So George Carlin's in it. Ivan Dixon, Bill Duke, Melanie Mayron. Hello, Lynn. You know, just a bunch of familiar faces. Antonio Fargas, and listening to the commentary track on this, you know, Universal didn't spend any time dealing with this film because they were dealing with a film in which the shark was not working.
Right.
So,
but that gives people free license
exactly.
to work. It's so great to work under the radar for cheap so that you get ignored. That way you can make the picture you want. That's what my favorite current director, Bobcat Goldthwait, does. Is
yes,
he's an
yes,
old school
he
punk
yep.
and he's like, I make it cheap. I do
Fast.
It under the radar.
Yep.
And they leave me alone. And that is why he can make these movies with topics and subject matters
yep.
that are so beyond. I mean, truly a punk rock filmmaker. And I think that people just think, you know, like
no,
he's just like
that's
a screaming
guy. That's a long
guy.
Time ago, friends. And by the way, he's been a panelist on NPR. So he's
so
one of
he's
ours.
Legit
he's
now.
Yeah, he's
yeah.
on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
But so. I really love him. And I think that, you know, he grabbed onto that. And these pictures that you're talking about, the ones that are the lesser
yep.
of that time period, other than Car Wash, what are some of your favorites?
Well, I also brought up, and this is not during that era, but ironically, 20th Century Fox had not one, not two, but three war films in 1970. They had Tora, 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 which I believe, if I remember right, was an American and Japanese co-production. Kurosawa was supposed to do the Japanese version and got fired, and they brought in somebody else. A little film called Patton, which won Best Picture, and George C. Scott won Best Actor. You know, didn't take it. So that meant they didn't pay attention to the other little film that they were making called MASH. Yeah. So anyway, going back to 75 to about 85, with the passing of Paul Sorvino, hi, Dee Dee.
R.I.P.
I talked about, because his wife is, I'm a regular panelist on her show, and she asked me the favorite Paul performances. Goodfellas, of course. I mentioned both versions of that championship season. One film that doesn't get enough love, and it's from that era, from I think like 1979, is called Slow Dancing in the Big City.
Directed, oh, I don't know it.
It's directed by John Avildsen. This is the film he did. Well, he did Rocky, then Fist with Sly, and then this. Sorvino plays a leading. He gets to be a romantic lead. He is a New York columnist who falls for a ballerina. And
I need to see this.
Yes, it's put out. I think it was United Artists. I have to find out what else was going on at that time. More than likely, a Bond film. And something else, but yeah, it's and John Avildsen, who there's a great documentary about him, where all of his films were about underdogs, everything from Rocky to The Karate Kid to The Power of One to Joe with Peter Boyle.
Yeah.
WW and the Dixie Dance Kings. Burt Reynolds is a Robin, Southern Robin Hood in the 1950s. Oh, yeah. You got to write these down.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's one of them. And another one I know my lovely wife actually saw in the theaters and enjoyed, I think also by United Artists, was called Those Lips, Those Eyes. And it's a summer theater kind of thing with a very young Tom Hulse right after Animal House and a slightly older but still young Frank Langella, who is the mentor to young Hulse. And this is right after Disco Dracula.
Yeah,
so,
which I like.
Well, of course you do. Open.
Shut up.
That's great hair there, Drac. Yeah, there's no gloss in Drac's hair in this one. So anyway, those are a few that kind of pop up. But I mentioned this because Times Square definitely qualifies for
1981.
That. 1981. What was it? Was Columbia?
Yes, I believe so. And
why don't you let folk? Well, I do some typing because this is intense.
Type away. You want me to talk about Times Square?
Tell them about Times Square because and also the fact that there's two versions of this film floating somewhere. So.
Well, yeah, I've only ever seen the one. So Times Square was in heavy rotation in 1981 on basic cable, we had at that time. And I was unsupervised and the TV was my best friend. And so this movie was absolutely so key to me becoming who I am. Not only because I watched it a million times, but because it starred two young women, and one of means and one who lived on the streets, and they hook up and they have a love affair, although that is downplayed by the studio, of course. We get to see them running around New York. And again, this is dirty, grimy New York. New York as I think of it. And Johnny LaGuardia is a key figure in this. He is a late night FM DJ, and he's played by Tim Curry. And one of the things that people most know now about this movie is the soundtrack. Now, as an 11-year-old growing up in Indianapolis with no elder siblings or cousins or anything nearby and not particularly well socialized, if it wasn't kind of mainstream, I wasn't going to be introduced to it, right? Like, I had to do some work for things. And this movie introduced me to most of the music that I love most in the world and still listen to today. The opening credits, which are beautiful. And are they Saul Bass opening credits in that? They look it if they are not. They are someone who loves Saul Bass, clearly. But are over Roxy Music, same old scene. This was the first time that I heard the Ramones. This was the first time that I heard Roxy Music. This was the first time that I heard so many things that I was unfamiliar with. And I kind of started on that path of doing the digging. It was also a movie, this along with Foxes, which came out about a year before, yep, with Jodie Foster, Sally Kellerman. They are two films that integrate music and the lives of young women, and they take them seriously. And that's not something that happens very often. In neither case are they overly sexualized. In neither case are they condescended to. And so as an adolescent, this was really appealing to me and really important to me. And so they actually just did a Blu-ray release, yes, of it. And it, Times Square had not been easy to find for many years because of the music rights, mm-hmm, issues, to, you know, come back to that. And now it's out and available again. And I just can't recommend it highly enough. I know that a lot of people now, when you look back on it, it will seem a little ham-handed, a little kitschy, a little childish. But
so were we.
Yeah. It's 11-year-old me watching that baby every time, and I love it.
And that's an example of when something hits you at the right time.
That's right.
When your life and a film connect, because sometimes you miss, sometimes it's too early, sometimes, yeah, it's too late. It happens.
Yeah.
So, okay. So I did a little bit of digging. My apologies to Columbia, sort of. What I have here, according to Wikipedia, production companies, EMI Films,
okay,
and this is what, Robert Stigwood Organization.
Right.
And then distributed by Associated Film Distribution. Now, Robert Stigwood, this was in between, oh boy.
He was doing big stuff then.
He started the decade with Jesus Christ Superstar, Tommy, Bugsy Malone, a doubleheader of Saturday Night Fever and Grease, then Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts,
ooh,
Club Band, Moment by Moment,
ooh,
Times Square.
Okay, Times Square is good.
Yeah, a move up. Fame as soundtrack producer, Empire Strikes Back as soundtrack producer, The Fan, the Laura Bacall,
right,
stalking,
right, right,
film,
right,
friends, Gallipoli, Grease 2, Staying Alive, and then Evita a decade later.
Wow,
so
I've strong feelings
right
about
there,
all of those.
Cocaine's,
yeah,
a hell of a drug.
It's a hell of a drug. And, you know, there's a lot of music in those. We're,
yeah,
really, I mean, really talking about some important pieces of music in a lot of those. And even if the movies weren't good, I think a lot of times the music sort of has stood the test of time in those. And, oh, gosh, Fame. I sure love that one, too.
So, yeah, or as Mrs. Soce likes to dismiss it, the Fame music. Not a fan of the electronic soundtracks. And yes, she's looking at you, Vangelis. We know you're dead. But, yeah, there is that. So, no,
right,
that's kind of, yeah, because I was I looked at Columbia Pictures from 1981. And since I have this on, what the hell? American Pop, Modern Romance, which I just watched, Albert Brooks.
Oh, right.
Because I just revisited. I found at a certain bookstore for half off, Lost in America. So I was very happy about that. Yeah, I was digging that. So Modern Romance, Happy Birthday to Me, which has also got a Blu-ray release from Kino Lorber. Hopefully
one
we'll
of my
next
favorites
yeah.
of the slasher genre.
Oh,
yeah. I like a lot of the lesser slashers, and that is a particular favorite. Yeah. Mary from Little House on the
Glenn
Prairie
Ford,
gone bad.
Yep. And yes, and a co-production with the Canadian Film Development Corporation. Somebody got a tax write-off.
Nice.
Nice Dreams for you Cheech and Chong fans. Stripes, one of their big ones. Heavy Metal.
Sure.
That's a staple of my.
Oh, yeah.
That's somewhere on cable right now.
It better be.
Yeah, nobody's.
I've had cable in years, but it better be.
Yeah, exactly. Nobody's Perfect. One from the Heart, which I need to revisit. That was Scorsese.
Right.
Coppola's
musical.
Very expensive musical on a lot. They did the distribution for Das Boot, Only When I Laugh. Oh, December 18th, 1981, the day before my 12th birthday. They decided to put out two films. One did well, the other did not. Absence of Malice and Neighbors.
Oh.
Yeah. So
wow.
that's Columbia,
that's
1981.
That's range.
So I would say, Stripes is probably One from the Heart. One from the Heart is your big, God, and they released that in August? You released that in December.
Yeah,
to try
that's
to get
a holiday
some
movie. For
ooh,
sure.
Boy. So, yeah, probably Nobody's Perfect. Nobody, and hardly anybody saw that. Stripes, probably not a lot of attention on that, especially with One from the Heart. Yeah, that's probably.
Yeah,
there is that. So yeah. So anyway, so we've been kind of going all over the map because that's what we do here at Film Sociology with my buddy Taffy. I want to wrap things up. We need to, speaking of another aspect of our childhood. We raise a glass to Jules Bass of Rankin and Bass. So. Your thoughts on the Rankin Bass? They were part of your holiday staple as well.
They definitely were, but I was one of those kids that was really sensitive to stuff, and I kind of loved/hated them. I would get really excited because it put me in the it's winter holidays, it's Christmas time, I'm so excited.
And then
you know.
The snowman shows
and
up.
Then
the abominable snowman shows up.
All of those were really depressing. And, you know, I think we can all agree that the messages in the Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer are terrible. We're going to ostracize you until we need you for something,
you know what,
you freak, and that's awful.
The alternate ending I want is for Rudolph to do kind of the scene from Half Bake. F you,
yeah.
F you,
and
F
you, you're okay.
Cool,
yeah.
F you, I'm out.
Yeah, that would be really satisfying.
Yeah.
So I hated that. And then there's one, and please forgive me because
uh-oh.
I don't remember which one.
Oh, don't worry,
I
have
oh,
some.
Good,
so
good.
Yeah, we have.
So there's one of them where there's a Burgermeister in the beginning.
Oh, that's
and
that's
there's
Santa
a whole,
Claus is coming to town.
Okay.
Yeah.
So there's a whole plot in the beginning of this, and then they literally say, "Well, everybody just forgot all about that." they don't resolve what happened, and they simply don't talk about it again. They're just like. Nobody ever talked about the Burgermeister again. Are you kidding me? I mean, I know it's for children, but
It was the townsman from M who took care of Peter Lorre. They just kind of put him aside. Guys in the red outfits from Don't Worry, Darling, which I finally watched this week. So
really
I don't know.
Annoying to me. So I don't know. I find the style of animation charming.
Okay.
I find the idea of them nostalgic and warm. But as soon as I start watching one, I start cursing a lot, and I get really mad, and I don't like it.
Without cocktails?
Yes, without.
Okay, all right. By the way, thank you for not making me have a seven-second delay on the show, dear.
I did pretty well.
We're not done yet, and you're still doing great. So, all right.
Cross my fingers.
We start with, 44 credits over a span of from 1987 to all the way back to 1960. God, the New Adventures of Pinocchio TV series from 1960, which probably meant it was on TV all the time when we were kids. First film directed The Daydreamer from 1966. Mad Monster Party from 1967, The Wacky World of Mother Goose from 67, Cricket on the Hearth, Mouse on the Mayflower. First one that I remember, and I've seen clips of these titles I've already mentioned, but I don't remember. But 1968, Little Drummer Boy.
Oh, sure.
That started it. The Smokey Bear Show, I don't remember. Frosty the Snowman, yes, from 1969. Santa Claus is Coming to Town, 1970. Mickey Rooney is Santa Claus. Fred Astaire is your, that's where Burgermeister came in. Here Comes Peter Cottontail, 1971. This explains a lot. Jewel Bass was a part of the animated series The Jackson 5 from 71 to 72. The Enchanted World of Danny Kaye, The Emperor's New Clothes from 1972. Ballad of Paul Bunyan, 1973. There was an animated 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, also 73. Twas the Night Before Christmas, 1974. Sure. That's the one with the mice. The Year Without a Santa Claus, 1974.
Yeah, that's kind of the biggie.
The First Easter Rabbit, 1976. Frosty's Winter Wonderland, 1976. See, he didn't melt. Rudolph's Shiny New Year. Little Drummer Boy Book 2. I didn't know that.
I didn't know that either.
A TV movie version of The Hobbit from 1977. Not Ralph Bashke. Nestor, the Long-Eared Christmas Donkey from 1977. Yeah, The Stingiest Man in Town, which I remember was a TV movie musical animated, and it was a Scrooge character voiced by Walter Matthau.
Oh, yeah, he's got two musical credits
in his resume. Thank you, Matthau.
That's great.
Jack Frost from 1979, Return of the King, not that one, from 1980. Pinocchio's Christmas, 1980. The Leprechaun's Christmas Gold, not that one. It's not Warwick Davis, from 1981. And in 1982, his last noted feature animated film, The Last Unicorn.
Oh.
Which is fairly messed up.
It's real messed up.
He is a part of that, as I've talked about, the messed up animated era of the mid-70s till about the early 80s.
Sure.
Looking at you, Fantastic Planet, The Mouse and His Child, Raggedy Ann and Andy, Watership Down, and
Watership
The Last Unicorn.
Watership Down traumatized me, and Raggedy Ann and Andy.
You know why? Because they played them during the daytime.
Those two movies are responsible for so many just
traumatized children. Here's the thing. Raggedy Ann and Andy, I will say, because I remember Dee Dee Khan was the voice of Raggedy Ann. It was after Grease, if I remember. But, you know, they're in whatever world they're in, and there's a princess or a ballerina or somebody blonde and skinny, and they are kidnapped by pirates, and then they spend most of the movie finding her, and then she's turned into Patty Hearst. She's become part of the pirate gang. Did not see that coming as a child, even though I knew the Patty Hearst story.
Right.
It was just like, wait, what?
Well, now she's turned and she's one of them.
Now she's one of them? Yeah, so that was a little traumatizing. And yes, Channel 100 programmers from the late 70s, you put Watership Down on in the daytime because you thought it was a cartoon about bunnies.
It's not.
Not. So
I think,
not.
Yeah, every Easter you should watch Watership Down and Night of the Lepus.
Oh God, no! Don't do that, friends.
Aren't you glad I never had children?
Yes. No, you're just hipster Auntie Mae.
I am.
But yeah, The Last Unicorn. I remembered this. So 1982, I am with my mother and her friends. We went to an obnoxious shopping mall in the Detroit suburbs. And, you know, I'm 12. I probably shopped for half an hour, and I'm like, I'm set.
Yeah.
I went to a double feature. This was the first feature, Last Unicorn. Yeah, Mia Farrow, Jeff Bridges, Alan Arkin. It's a trip. I mean, not nearly as trippy as the ones we mentioned, but still kind of.
It's out there, yeah.
But the second film I saw, because Siskel and Ebert raved about it, and it's been with me ever since, is Educating Rita. Because I want to play Frank someday.
That's a charming movie. And you know how much I love Michael Caine.
Yes. And this is him actually doing a film because he wants to do it, not because he has to buy a house.
Yeah.
Yes, he's not doing it. And this is at the height of the, I never saw the film, but The View from the House is lovely.
Yeah.
And he actually did a legit film. And I get
hipster points
because I knew Mrs. Weasley way before Mrs. Weasley. Right, so right. Anyway, but yeah, I saw a double feature of The Last Corn and Unicorn and Educating Rita. So
that explains so much about you.
Thank you, Jules Bass. So yeah, that's you know, it's like the picture, the promo photo for this program. I'm holding up two Blu-rays. They were DVDs, and then enough time has passed, I converted them to Blu-rays of Rashomon and Blackula. That's
you all over.
Thank you, dear.
Yeah, that's you all over. Y'all can't see this, but he is wearing a Blackula T-shirt right now.
Well, this is the work uniform, you know.
It's great. Yeah, that was one of the things that we bonded over early on was our mutual love of blaxploitation films, but also Kurosawa.
And apparently animated films that traumatized us.
Yeah.
Oh, let's not forget Fox and the Hound. We got through it. Somehow we got through it. We're okay.
I don't even want to think about these things anymore.
So Taffy, besides the copious notes on Eyes of Laura Mars, have you been able to watch anything else at your own leisure?
I have.
Please.
I have to say that I'm a big fan of Pluto, because it's free, for one.
I was about to say, Tim Burton remake?
No,
the channel.
That's Dumbo, silly. And no. No, the channel. Okay. Pluto, it's free. It's great.
She has titles written down. This is my audience right here. By the way, the grab a pencil people,
right. But these are really great. I am a documentary freak. I love a documentary. So I watched two documentaries this week that really made an impression on me. Really enjoyed both of them, not only because they were interesting subject matter and interesting subjects, but because they were nice. They made me feel good.
This is something very special, friends, because
I like the dark darkness.
Yeah, you do. So the fact that I can see a little bit of sunshine and Taffy in my world, because same here.
Black sunshine.
Yeah, there's.
So the first one was called The Sarnos, A Life in Dirty Movies. And this is a really, don't act surprised.
I think I've seen this. It's really good.
It's pretty recent. I want to say it's 2020.
Okay.
I could be wrong on that.
That's all right.
But it's a really excellent documentary about Joe Sarno and his wife, Peggy Steffens. And they've been married for like 40 years. And it's not only a great and unexpected love story there. They're really darling. But also, it's a terrific chronicle of the early days of sexploitation pictures.
I'm sorry, I've actually seen this. Yeah, Life in Dirty Movies, because it was released by Film Movement. Thank you, Film Movement.
Thank you, Film Movement.
Yes, I have that. That's
so,
yes.
Yeah, it was really great because you get to see the stuff that, like, we talk a lot, well, we being you and me and all my friends, so I don't know if the general public is talking about this a lot, but we, in my corner of the world, talk a lot about the golden era of porn. Which is a favorite for me. And this is a great look at what kind of led up to that. So this is when dirty movies were a little less dirty and a little more movie because they just couldn't show so much. And then eventually he emerged into doing harder things. But it's a really great kind of look at an almost lost era there.
And you could also complement this with Brian Glazer actually produced the documentary Inside Deep Throat.
Right.
So, and that brings up the porno chic that was brief, but, you know, it was there. So they knew
it absolutely is.
They knew that the studios could make money. That's how films like Emmanuel were made and others. I mentioned Sarno, and I'll shamelessly plug Film Movement. They also have, Vampire Ecstasy, Sin You Sinners, Confessions of a Young American Housewife, in the Suburbs. Those I've actually seen and own. All the Sins of Sodom, Vibrations. It's about good stuff. And Deep Throat Part 2. Anyway,
right.
that's all. Check out Film Movement. But yeah, there is that era.
Yeah, so this really gives you a look at what the buildup was for that era. It's a really great, great and interesting and well put together movie. And then the other, and this was just one of those, it's Pluto, so instead of seeking out a thing, you can passively watch. And this is what just kind of came up on their documentary channel, and I left it on, and I was so glad that I did, It's one called Herb Alpert Is.
Oh, yeah.
Again, that's new. I think it was in the last couple of years.
Herb just came in the town recently.
So obviously the music's great.
Yep.
Right? You know, but I didn't know anything about him.
Yeah, he was more than just trumpet guy.
He was so interesting, and he was so sort of warm and positive, mm-hmm. and the story of he and his wife was really romantic, and there's all this great music, and even as an elder, he's like spent his life kind of passing things along and ensuring music and arts education for other people. And I was just like, well, if this isn't the warmest, fuzziest little thing, it's just terrific. So definitely, I highly recommend both of those.
Good. And this is
for
my
free.
This is my annual reminder to ask Mrs. Soci to recreate the whipped cream album cover. So
has she still not done that?
Hope springs eternal.
I'll do that one.
You mean you have? I thought you have already.
Yeah, well, you know what I haven't done though.
Uh oh. What?
Much
dear?
To my regret.
Oh, be careful.
I've never. No, it's all right.
Okay. Yes.
I know it's PBS, NPR, whatever. I have never popped out of a cake. How did I make it to 52 years old and I've never popped out of a cake?
Well, hope springs eternal. So.
Yeah, I guess. When's your birthday? December?
December 19th.
Oh,
it's making a short cake. It's a short cake.
We're very funny, aren't we?
Rum cake, because you're also a drinker.
Well, I have been known to tipple.
Yeah, and then I'll hop out of it. So. No, anyway. Also same height. But she gets on my shoulders. We can stop anybody. All right, Taffy. Once more, show off your socials and where
Absolutely.
Can people listen to more.
Okay,
of you?
So you can find me pretty much 24 hours a day on the Twitters at Taffeta V. My website where you can find everything from costumes I've done to things I've written and guest appearances on other podcasts like this one and Golan Globus. Hey, fellas. As well as my own podcasts, you can go to taffetav.com and find all of that goodness. Yes, I have recently relocated, so I will be starting up my podcast late again very soon. I'm certainly always open to guesting on other things. Soci, if you ever decided you needed to make this a two-hander.
Well, I was thinking, you know, it's been a while since I've had a Tony Randall / Terry Garr here on
see,
the show.
Oh, see, there you go.
See, 'cause for those who don't know, and Mike Perry, you used to be one of those, I know, but back when Letterman was on NBC, I think the story is Tony Randall and Terry Garr lived like down the block from NBC, and if a guest dropped out, they would just call these two and they would run over and do the show.
Absolutely, yeah, and that is factual, and that can be me now.
Famous last words.
Listeners, so. Please write in with your requests to have Taffeta V.
Thank you.
Yes, I'm shameless.
Thank you, Moneypenny.
Thank you, James.
Yeah, the new Terry Garr of film sociology. That's Taffeta V. She's at a beck and call for the program. It's nice to have that. So, yeah, it's always good to have her there. But, yeah, Kino Lorber has Eyes of Laura's Mars coming out very soon. I jumped the gun on it, but when I wrote that I was watching that film, Taffy jumped at the chance to talk about it, and there's the result. So there you go. And thank you, Moneypenny. I appreciate it. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Before we grab a pencil, let's go around the horn and see where things are happening. Over at the Tibbs Drive-In this weekend, on Screen 1 is Black Adam and Smile. Screen 2, here you go. The original Nightmare on Elm Street, the original Friday the 13th, and for Murray and Griff, the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Screen 3, Halloween Ends and Terrifier 2. And in Screen 4, here we go, the original House on Haunted Hill from 1959, Wasp Woman from 1959, The Screaming Skull from 1958, and 1922's Nosferatu, all happening at the Tibbs Drive-In this weekend. At the Skyline Drive-In this weekend, Friday, is Poltergeist, the original Poltergeist, and Trick or Treat. And then Saturday, October 29th, Hotel Transylvania and the original Ghostbusters, Family Halloween Party, Costume Contest, Trick-or-Treating, all that good stuff at the Skyline Drive-In in Shelbyville. At IU Cinema, Friday night at 7 o'clock. If you're a quick listener to the podcast, I appreciate it. A double feature of Shaun of the Dead and Slither. And then at 11 o'clock, a double feature of Kill List and The Descent. Saturday, October 29th at 1 o'clock, the Creative Collaborations Information Session. Saturday, October 29th at 4 p.m. from 1939, the film Midnight with Claudette Colbert, John Amici, and John Barrymore. Saturday, October 29th at 7 p.m., Me and My Brother from 1969. Tuesday, November 1st at 7 p.m., the documentary from 2020, Crip Camp. Thursday, November 3rd at 7 p.m., the documentary Blaxploitation, 100 Years of Blackness in Italian Cinema. And then Friday, November 4th at 7 p.m. from 1930, Earth and Zemlya. Saturday, November 5th at 7 p.m. from 1923, Color Fidel. That's a silent film with live accompaniment. Tuesday, oh, that was canceled. And finally, Thursday, November 10th at 7 p.m. from 2012, Robot and Frank. All of that is happening at IU Cinema. At the Historic Art Craft Theater in Franklin, Friday, October 28th at 7:30 p.m., The Craft from 1996. On Saturday, October 29th at 11 a.m. and 2 p.m., Cartoons for Cans. And then Saturday night, October 29th at 7:30 p.m., Shaun of the Dead. All of that is happening at the Historic Art Craft Theater in Franklin. Over at the Can-Can, Tar, Candyman, Louis Armstrong's Black and Blues, Triangle of Sadness. All of that is happening there. So there you go. Oh, Seven Samurai happening on November 1st with a whiskey tasting. I got to work on that. All right, grab a pencil. Let's find out what you've been watching. We start on Twitter. And David, it's so good to hear from this David, David A., D-A-A, you know who you are. But he wrote, I watched Papillon again, which I'm assuming the original Papillon, because why would you watch the remake of Papillon more than once? We go to Facebook, and Michael writes, Jailhouse Rock, Bunny Lake is Missing, The Lost City, Ivanhoe, Cover Girl, Out of the Past, Fury, Jurassic World Dominion, The Big Steel, and They Were Expendable. Eden writes, The Northman. Jesse writes, Hoxton, House, God's Creature, Poltergeist, and The Rocky Horror Picture Show. Dustin writes, Black Adam. Brian writes, we watch Final Destination, a movie that scared Monica as a teenager, but mostly made us chuckle and roll our eyes last night. Scary John Denver. The cleverest thing about it is that all the characters are named after classic horror legends like Browning, Luton, Hitchcock, etc., all of whom made better movies than this. Thank you, Brian. And Brian also sent me a note later that they watched Bride of Frankenstein, which is, yeah, legit film, not a sequel. We all know that. But glad to hear that, Brian. Thank you. And tell Monica there's hay. So David writes Elysium, The Outfit, which he recommends, and the Gary Oldman, the Francis Coppola's Bram Stoker's Dracula. Kevin writes just the truth. This film is locally produced and features a full cast of local talent. Sarah Castillo Danarand is featured in the lead role of Laura, political drama. Yes, Kevin, thank you for reminding me of that. Look for the film Just the Truth. Ask me for info and I'll send it to Kevin as well. David writes The Majestic and The Fly. Teresa writes Shawshank Redemption, The Birds, The Blind Side, and Hocus Pocus. Daniel writes Becoming Cary Grant. Helen, take note. The Cat and the Canary, 1939. Sleep My Love, Hump Day. Mrs. Palfrey at the Claremont, The Misadventures of Merlin Jones, Magnificent Obsession, Bridesmaids, Remember the Night, Don John, and House of Dark Shadows. Craig writes, Lust for a Vampire, Had to Laugh, Steve Coogan did a parody of this in a thing called Lesbian Vampire Lovers of Lust. I think I remember that. Also writes, To the Devil, a Daughter, and then Craig writes, just started Burnt Offerings from 1976. That's right, Oliver Reed, Karen Black, Betty Davis, Burgess Meredith, Eileen Eckert, Lee Montgomery. Yeah, that's all of those. Joan writes, August Osage County. I had forgotten how intense that movie is. Thank you, dear. Molly writes, Hocus Pocus 2, Taming of the Shrew, the RSC production from 2019, and The Nightmare Before Christmas. Eric writes, first view, The Good Nurse, rewatch of Three Kings, and an abundance of Bogart at his best. Dead End, Dark Victory, The Roaring Twenties, High Sierra, The Maltese Falcon, Casablanca, and Sahara. Not a bad stretch at all, Eric. Thank you. Jamie writes, Blythe Spirit, Hocus Pocus, Encanto, and Hocus Pocus 2. Jeff writes, starring Adam West. Bob Bloom writes, murder anyone? John writes, reading Gene Wilder's autobiography, so started rewatching his older movies. The televised Death of a Salesman from 1966. Yeah, I own that on DVD, John. It's Lee J. Cobb as Willie. Biff is played by George Segal. Gene Wilder plays Bernard. It's a really good production. And I love Lee J. Cobb, and I love Death of a Salesman. So, yeah, definitely worth checking out. Also, Bonnie and Clyde. And then writes, Wilder has only 37 actor credits, and he's always been a favorite of mine. And he had the nerve as a young student to stand up to Lee Strasberg. Yes, he did. So very good, John. I'm glad you're doing that. Robert Muggy writes, Darling, Cece, Le Choices de la Vie, Max and the Junkman, Ron Carter Finding the Right Notes. Yeah, that's really good. And, oh, Ken Russell's The Lair of the White Worm. I believe that's streaming because it's October. Yeah, I own a physical copy of it, what have you. Jessica writes, Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban, Little Monsters, Mara, Return to House on Haunted Hill, The Gracefield Incident, and Guillermo del Toro's Cabinet of Curiosities, the series. Thank you, Jessica. Miss you, stage wife. Austin Glidden, Medium Cool Podcast. Marcel Lachelle with Shoes On, Blonde, Vortex, and Brian and Charles. Cassie writes The Wiz and An Amish Haunting. Barbara writes The Good Nurse. Tom writes The Blob with Steve McQueen of Beech Grove. Thank you, Tom. Yes, he is in that. Gary writes Sicario, The Addams Family, 2019, Man-Eater of Hydra, that's Elvira's movie macabre, Spook Anarchy, Always Shine, and Black Adam. Terry writes Scanners, White Echo, Battle for the Planet of the Apes, and The Mysterians. No question mark, just The Mysterians. Abby writes The Hitman's Bodyguard and Welcome to Raccoon City. Cassandra writes Failure to Launch. And finally, Beverly writes Crimes of the Heart. And there you go, friends. That's what you've been watching this week. So hopefully you got to watch some movies that are good and that are new, at least new to you, as well as falling back on old favorites. And of course, it is the season. So if you're into scary movies, and it's okay if you're not, it's fine. There'll be other things to watch. There's plenty out there. All right, friends, some words to live by.
Silent Breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
Go see a good movie. You deserve it. There's plenty out there. We're getting in the grown-up movie season a little closer. Thanks to Taffeta V for always hanging out and being at a beck and call. Shout out to the Golden Globus guys. Congratulations on your Jalloween. And next week they're talking about Vice Squad. And that film messed me up a little bit when I watched it on cable. My first two Wings Hauser experiences were Vice Squad and when he appeared on the TV series Hunter. Very effective work. So anyway, can't wait to hear that. And until next time, take care, everybody. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!